Hello and welcome back for another podcast episode of Acetopolitics. I know the last episode is quite some time ago, but nonetheless, the most recent developments in Syria and obviously in Israel, Palestine, whatever you want to call it, basically prompted me to come back with a more in-depth analysis and a more in-depth assessment of what has happened. More importantly, of course, of what is going to happen in the next couple of years. In one of my most recent articles, namely The Collapse of Arabia, Why Sub-Anatolia Failed and How It Can Recover, I analyzed the situation from a different perspective, like a more zoomed out perspective, and offering basically how the conflict-ridden region of Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and obviously Israel, Palestine can recover and come back to the glory days of when Jerusalem, Damascus, Beirut, and obviously Baghdad were cities with much wealth, peace, and prosperity. In this episode here, so, and by the way, I'm going to link the article obviously in this description. So I invite all of you to read it. And also comment on it, give me some feedback. That would be very interesting and very interesting discussion to have with you guys. So in this episode, I'm going to talk about the broader picture of what is happening right there in Syria. And it is a bit more complicated now that we have a certain result with the government failing and the former president Assad leaving the country, the Syrian army, like the rebel army, basically took over Damascus. And now, obviously, you know, it's the straightforward thinking in these kind of situations with people who are not very close with political dynamics is to say, okay, now the nation can recover, grow back into prosperity, but it's not going to be that easy. The reason for that is that Israel now has made major advances into Syrian territory, and there's little known about what is really going on there in terms of like territorial expansion by Israel. We all know that Israel also attacked Lebanon and made advances into Lebanese territory as well, without really having a justification for that. Obviously, it's always under the false pretense of, you know, going against terrorist groups. But, for example, when Turkey is attacking terrorist groups in other regions, such as northern Syria and Iraq, we have a massive uproar because those terrorist organizations are then all of a sudden portrayed as freedom fighters, right? So there are a lot of things going wrong in the situation in the south of Syria and Lebanon, with Israel expanding beyond the Golan Heights, which are actually a demilitarized zone, or were for a long time. They are no longer a demilitarized zone by the United Nations, and they're now making further advances into Syrian territory, utilizing the power vacuum that is persistent in Syria after the fall of the government. On the other side, Turkey has made major advances in the northern parts of Syria, as well as into the terrorist territories where, basically the organizations of PKK and what was the other one called? What is a similar organization? That's like an umbrella term for the Kurdish militias that are up there. Obviously, the Syrian rebels won against Assad. And now, bringing all these factors together, and obviously without having empiric evidence of it, and I have to stress this because these kind of things, you know, if we would have empiric evidence, the whole public discussion would be a whole lot different. I'm just making assumptions and assessments on the actions that we are seeing there on the ground, and what the strategic rationale is behind those actions. So the Syrian government fails. Russian support is no longer existent. You know, they're pulled out of Syria. Reason for that in the first place was We saw that Israel and Turkey basically had like concerted actions in Syria simultaneously. So they basically, and it seems like they were kind of in an agreement when to attack and when to enter Syria, because they opened two fronts at once in Syria, making it difficult for the Syrian army to act against it. That's the first part. The second part of it is that the Syrian rebel army, right, the Free Syrian Army, I believe they call themselves, also launched attacks during more or less the same time. Now, that being so, it is quite obvious that there must be some kind of coordination between these three actors, because it's not a coincidence that they move on Syria and Damascus, especially during the same time. So basically, like Bashar al-Assad, the former president, was faced with three fronts. The southern front with Syria, utilizing like the power vacuum that has emerged with the fights that have been going on with the Free Syrian Army. On the other side, we have another strong actor with Turkey in the north. So basically, the collapse of the Syrian army and government is comes by no surprise. Obviously, Russia wasn't able to support Syria any longer with that kind of power that they have had before, because they have an own war where they have to pull or put all their resources in. So they pulled away. So it seems like coordinated action to bring down Syria. And the deal is quite clear. The Free Syrian Army gets Aleppo and obviously Damascus, the most important regions or cities in the nation, basically also gaining control over the whole of Syria. On the other side, the Israelis gain control over the southern lands, bordering to Israel, and right now the Golan Heights, where there are very important water resources, by the way, in most of the arid regions of the world. They gain access to those with a more official, or with a more how can we say it, a more authoritative claim, on the Golan Heights where the water resources are. And on the other side, Turkish forces gain the north, where there are Turkish minorities, obviously around Idlib, for a couple of years they're using Turkish currency and, it is administered by Turkish minorities. But on the other side, there is also kind of the advantage to go against the terrorist groups that control bordering lands, and they're making advances in the Turkish territory with attacks, not really advances, but, attacking Turkish border cities. And obviously, there's also a lot of advantage for Turkey to be involved in that, and also gain some land from northern Syria. It seems like a coordinated agreement and move on the Syrian state. Obviously, it failed, and it adds another episode within a lot of failed states in that region, including now Lebanon, which is under attack by Israel, and Iraq as well. Jordan has kind of left out of this for quite some time now, but we never know when they are going to be next, basically. Now, considering those moves, we saw that the timing and the way those three actors moved on the Syrian government at once, shows kind of, an agreement and some sort of strategic layer or dimension behind it. But also on the other side, we'll have to see it at a foreign policy aspect, that has been going on. With, in the United States of America, switching the regime from a politician that is not really like cognitively capable of doing anything in politics, namely Joe Biden, who basically supported vested Israel with a blank check, to another president who's going to assume office soon, namely Donald Trump, who's outspokenly against conflict and also known for leaving the sub-Anatolian lands alone, and also being able to speak up against Israel unlike most other presidents of that very nation. So once he comes back, the capital flow from the United States of America to Israel, as well as the foreign policy support, is not going to be that great anymore. The impact, you know, is going to vastly decrease, and therefore, you know, important resources are going to be pulled away. I believe just recently, you know, they had like another round of financial support for Israel in their efforts to, expand their territories. And therefore, I think the rush and, you know, the streamlined action taken against Syria in this scenario comes by no surprise, in order to also use this power vacuum and go against the Syrian state. So we have quite some, and I believe you'll get now why I do not use so much empirical evidence, because there is none, basically. It's very difficult, you know, to get an authoritative statement from a politician who says, okay, yeah, well, this is our strategy, you know, we want to take over Syria, and we use the Free Syrian Army and talk with the Turks, you know, that we move at once. Obviously, nobody's going to admit it, but the actions should display like this kind of coordination and cooperation among those actors, as well as the timing and utilization of the power vacuum of one of the most important allies of Israel. So what does that tell us about the future of sub-Anatolia? It means basically that, you know, Israel is going to establish itself as probably the most important actor in the region. Obviously, Israel was never a weak state. You know, we know that from the three Arab-Israeli wars in the 20th century. But we also know it from the last couple of years, where Israel made clear, you know, that they really want to integrate the remaining lands of Palestinians, namely Gaza and the West Bank, into the Israeli state. And this is what they're going to do. I wrote this in many, many articles. This is the vision that they have, and they're going after it with full force. On the other hand, you know, expanding into Syrian territory and Lebanese territory will strengthen their position even more. And at this point, you know, other actors such as Egypt and Turkey and Iran, they are going to be, you know, struggling, you know, to keep up power parity, since they, the Israelis, displaying so much power and influence in the region, obviously gaining access to very important resources such as oil and gas, as well as water, you know, the most important resource in the region. Until now, Turkey was basically the main source of water for the region. But now with Israel, you know, expanding the territories, it might not change, you know, but they might be a little bit more independent. On the other hand, you will also have to see that such a strong actor who made coordinated, you know, moves on the Syrian government with the Free Syrian Army. This means basically that they have, or you can assume at least, that they have also some sort of significant influence on this Free Syrian Army, because, you know, these are no institutionalized, they don't have any institutionalized organizations, entities, or some sort of, you know, state statementship experience, right? So they're not really politicians, they're not really bureaucrats, they are not really vested with financial resources to maintain independence and autonomy. So on paper, yes, basically they took over Syria, the flag changed, etc., etc. But behind the scenes, I mean, it's very unlikely that Syria right now, with the new government, is going to be that strong, you know, to withstand Israeli influence, whether it be financially or politically or militarily, right? So the power politics behind it is much more complex than just saying, okay, well, they have a state now, you know, they govern it. But, you know, Israel is so much stronger than them. And we have like the apparent coordination of, you know, advancing on Damascus, that we have to assume, we almost have to assume, that Israel is very influential in Syria and on the new government. Basically making the new Syrian state a vassal state in the region, even further expanding the territorial integrity and, you know, reach of Israel. You know, bordering Iraq, you know, this is going to be another factor. Will a lot of oil resources, we don't know if they're going to, you know, also aim at making advances on Iraq. For whatever reason, it might be that another destabilizing effect, such as like extremist groups, might pop up there in the next couple of years. And whenever that happens, this is not going to be a coincidence, right? Because right now, if we see the expansionist policies of nations in the 21st century, it's not like in the Middle Ages where armies, you know, march on cities, you know, they besiege them and, you know, basically enter the capitals and gain control of the lands. Today, it's much, much more subtle, in the sense that, you know, rebel groups and uprisings and these kind of things happen, destabilize nations, right? Those movements are basically fed with funds and weapons until the destabilization of the state advances to such a degree that they take over and they become vassal states of the supporting parties, as we saw in Syria. And this might also happen in Iraq once the new Syrian government is established and Israel really has a tight grip on the new government. And it is reasonable to assume so, because I mean there are different groups in Iraq. They still didn't recover from the second Gulf War. There are massive resources. There's also the geopolitical interest, you know, in moving closer to Iran, you know, to threaten them. So it might be that we see a religious group popping up in Iraq over the next couple of years, probably 1.5-2 years. Usually that's the time frame, you know, when people forget what happened in Syria and they assume that this is the new normal. And then all of a sudden the news are going to be filled with, you know, all sorts of news on the new group, you know, the new threat basically in Iraq, and all of a sudden no longer in Syria, right? Because they are basically under the control of Israel. On the other hand, Turkey is going to remain quiet for quite some time and might not understand what is going on there, because I believe that in order to keep Turkey out of the territorial struggles in Syria and Iraq, Israel might channel some support through Syria, the new vassal state of Israel, to basically fight against the northern Syrian insurgent groups, like the terrorist groups with the Kurdish ideology, basically. So by doing so, you get rid of the main concern in the bordering regions of Turkey. And because the interests there are served for quite some time, you prevent Turkey from further entering Syrian lands or Iraqi lands. So it's kind of like the isolation, because you give Turkey what it wants and, you know, keep the most powerful actor, by the way, in the region, quiet for some time. So these are obviously hypotheses, definitely. But with the way things are going for Israel right now, these coordinated actions, you know, how they are put together, this is very, it makes a lot of sense for them, because they want to establish themselves there as the main power. Obviously, they need more land. And obviously, the foreign policy of Israel has always been expansionist. And yeah, the power vacuum and the destruction of the Arab lands serves them well. And on the other hand, they also have like the necessary media presence, you know, to divert the attention away. So nobody is really looking at, you know, what is going on there. I mean, this is a bit of a far-fetched hypothesis, but, you know, if you think about the most recent attack in Germany on the Christmas market, we saw those kind of tactics, you know, being applied to proliferate a fear within the population in Germany. They have like re-elections, but on the other side, if it turns out, you know, to be a Muslim extremist who basically injured more than 200 people, this is also something, you know, that is going to pull the interest and the attention from the broader public towards the issue of religious extremism under the name of Islam. Pulling away the attention from the conflicts that we have in Lebanon and Syria right now. So they are all kind of interlinked things if those hypotheses are true. From a strategic point of view, timing-wise, and the way the narratives are put together, it makes perfect sense. It might even be that if we look further into the future and also, there are going to be uprisings in Iraq a couple of years later, another destabilizing effect, and maybe a new government emerges there, and Israel can extend the influence into Iraq as well. There's no reason not to believe that Turkey is going to be next. And obviously, you know, we've seen many... we have much evidence of the Jewish belief, you know, having interest in Anatolian lands, with the Euphrates and Tigris springs being in Turkey. It might also be that there is like kind of a normative agenda, you know, to move into Anatolia. But this is like step three or four, you know, on the way of territorial expansion in the region. And all I'm trying to say is that the developments that we are seeing right now in Syria are not really coincidences, and they're not really driven by the democratic will of the people. I believe, and my, you know, reasoning and my strategic understanding of what is happening there really points to one major thing, and this is something that I pick up in the article that I referred to in the beginning. Arabia, or Arabs in general, right? Like, the Arabs are like a people who never really had like a long-standing state tradition and long-standing state experience. Arabia, so the region of Lebanon, Israel, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Palestine, was able to be so peaceful for many centuries because they were administered by a nation that had those experiences, and obviously the power and you know, the expertise to build huge empires, namely the Ottomans. For many centuries, there was peace there. Obviously, you know, there were more peaceful times and less peaceful times. But after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, right, it really showed that the Arab people, basically as one people, right, were not able to build sustainable state structures, yeah, except for Saudi Arabia. But there we have a rentier state, which is fully independent from the tax revenue the tax income from the citizens, but purely reliant on oil and basically also foreign relations. Saudi Arabia has always been a vassal state of the United States of America ever since they discovered that there's so much oil. So they basically understood that when they, you know, basically sell all the oil to the United States of America and make them an influential player in the region, they are going to benefit from it. But there's no such thing as democracy there. All the other nations, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq, you know, they basically decided to put up, or better said, the British and the French decided to build states there. And at some point they tried to be autonomous, and this didn't work because those nations, all Arab people basically, lack the understanding of what it takes to build a strong state. Not because they're incapable of doing so, but because they were lacking the long-standing state tradition that other nations and civilizations had. This is not to say that they are never able to do that, but, you know, within those couple of years of being independent, and with all the foreign pressure, and also in a kind of a situation where they, after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, fell into the situation of the Second World War, where the European nations extracted much of the economic value by, you know, exploiting those nations, you know, it was not really possible for them to build those state traditions. Most of the leaders were basically installed leaders who greatly benefited from the European regimes personally. So there was no intrinsic motivation to build up like autonomous Syrian or Iraqi nations or something like that. And we still see this today. And whenever something like this happened, whether it's Gaddafi in Libya, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, or Assad in Syria, whenever this happened, you know, the foreign pressure on those nations increased by so much that either the leaders really turned into maniacs, which some of them really did, or they toppled the regimes either directly or mostly, in most cases, indirectly through like the so-called promotion of democracy, so public diplomacy. This was also one of the main reasons, by the way, why the Arab Spring basically emerged in the first place. The National Endowment for Democracy, a North American organization, basically made institution building a common norm, like in those nations, and proliferated the ideas of the European and neo-European democratic ideals. So the reason why we are seeing the collapses of Arab nations and Arab societies today is because they are lacking the state tradition. In the article that I'm writing, it is pointed out that if those Arab regions and societies want to establish themselves as great societies once again, and we have to say, you know, the Arab civilization was one of the most important civilizations in history because they added so much to science, literature, art, and music over the centuries, that without them, you know, we would be only halfway in astronomy and physics and so on and so forth. They are an integral part of this culture, and they're very important, and we need them, you know, to come back and work on those things in a productive, effective, and efficient manner. The reason why they can't is the foreign pressure has increased so much because it has been understood from the outside, especially from Israel, Europe, and neo-European nations, that when they split up the Arabs, they're never going to fulfill their potential and never going to grow to strength. In the article, I'm saying if the Arab societies want to succeed, they will have to come together, you know, and form a supranational entity. There is no such thing as the Syrian or the Iraqi. You know, over the last 100 years, these kind of things popped up and developed, but it's not a really distinct culture, to be perfectly honest. So the Arabs would be better off, you know, to build a supranational entity. And as I said, right now with the expansion of Israel into Syria and basically establishing a vassal state in Syria, it is all the more important that Arab people, you know, come back to the pan-Arab Arabic idea of being one people and pulling together their forces and setting aside all the, divergent interests that emerged over the last 100 years. Obviously, incredibly difficult, and it seems like, if you have a supranational entity such as the Ottoman Empire, you know, which would administer those lands in the manner that they did before, you know, Arabia would still be better off. But right now it emerges into a situation where Israel seems to also have understood how the, you know, the societal setup is more suited to a supranational entity, and they might be the supranational hegemon that can emerge over the next 100 years. If that happens, you know, there's a big difference between the Ottomans and the Israelis. First of all, religiously, there's no need to talk about that. But on the other side, the Ottoman rule has also shown in Europe that they were never about, you know, changing people normatively. It was just about the administration of land, you know, collecting taxes, expanding military power, but never about, you know, affecting people's culture. Israel, on the other side, has the opposite track record, you know, of influencing cultures. You know, this is why they're also very strong in the media landscape. This is also why they are so deep into the, pharmaceutical game of DNA testing and around narratives concerning, racial topics. Their massive involvement in the Black Lives Matter movement. And so on and so forth. So Israel is normatively driven, and the race aspect is a very important thing to them. And them being basically the hegemon of Arabia would lead to a massive disconnect between the people and the government there. So in order to prevent that, you know, that there's only one really good option for Arabs at this point. And this is pan-Arabism. Yeah, that's the only way to go. Because on the other hand, if we fall into a situation, you know, of still detrimental policymaking in the Arab world, the next player that might be pulled into this whole thing is Turkey or Iran. Maybe Iran before Turkey. But either way, you know, whenever one of those nations enter the conflict, because their core interests, you know, are being compromised in the region. Believe me, the war that is going to follow is nothing compared to what has been going on in the last couple of years. It's going to be much, much bigger, right? The Arab Spring and the Syrian civil war, they are going to be much smaller than a war that is, that might emerge from too much Israeli influence in the region, because the forces that clash together are much bigger. Obviously, this is going to be a much more utopic hypothesis at this point, because we are not there yet. But if we think about it linearly and even exponentially, it is possible that we might see a scenario like this, maybe in 10 to 30 years, something like that. But it all comes down to whether Israel, or how quickly Israel, is going to strengthen its hold on the new Syrian government, how they're going to expand the power there, and whether other nations understand it and act against it, you know, with alliance building here and there. But in that case, you know, a supported government by Israel in Syria, whenever other governments or like other nations are going to approach them, you know, to cooperate and maybe, you know, look for a more independent way, you have to think about Israel supporting yet another group or stirring up the situation, therefore another civil war, again creating a power vacuum, again expanding in territory-wise, and so on and so forth. So the basic interest of territorial expansion of Israel stands against all other principles that we have of good governance, whether it is popular sovereignty, national sovereignty of people of any nation, basically, or if we think about, you know, balance of power in a region, they're basically going against it because they have one direction, you know, and it's going to be in conflict with a lot of interest of the neighboring states. It is a very hypothetical discussion, and I'm underlining this because I'm aware of the far-fetchedness of what I'm saying, right? But just because it sounds far-fetched, it doesn't mean it isn't happening. I mean, if we look at the actions, you know, that took place over the last couple of weeks, and the actions that have been taking place over the last couple of years, there is high consistency in Israeli state behavior going against other nations and populations, right? And with their increased power, there's nothing that speaks against, you know, the exponential nature of utilizing those added powers. I wish I could also include more empiric evidence, as I said before, but, you know, nobody is going to admit that these are the strategic considerations behind it. And in the end, it just comes down whether the things that I said, you know, whether they materialize or not. I hope they do not, and I hope I'm wrong about what I'm saying, because that would imply that there is going to be a grave power discrepancy established in the region. It would also mean that Turkey is basically cooperating with Israel, you know, to establish those new dynamics there. And if that is true, the relations with Turkey and between Turkey and other nations is also going to be strained, including Russia. So I hope these things are not going to become reality. But as things stand right here, and you know, with the strategic direction this is going, it seems very likely that we would see, yeah, more of an open battlefield between states in the future than it was before among non-governmental organizations. I think the times of you know, many insurgent groups and splitted interest among those groups are basically over. I think the big players are coming back, as we see right now. You know, this is not to say that there are no militias and terrorist groups emerging. As I said, there is a possibility that we see that such groups, you know, pop up in Iraq over the next couple of years. But with the clear statement of Israel that they really want more territory in the region, and they're, you know, occupying it and conquering it, basically, we might see more big state involvement there. Maybe some final remarks on what I've been saying here. The whole situation is still much more complex than what I just described here. There are many resource considerations that we are not aware of. I mean, obviously, the biggest ones are water and oil. These are the biggest resources that there are in the region, and they the actors want to gain control over them. That's one thing. There are also foreign policy considerations that we cannot really grasp and follow, including me, because there are some strategic spots, geographical areas that are very important, you know, for the nations to place military units in. But there are are also some strategic economic areas, such as the cities on the Silk Road. I mean, they have been prosperous for centuries, or millennia even, because they have been, on, as I said, important geographical economic spots. There's also a historic dimension, you know, that plays into those kind of things. I just went back to the Ottoman Empire, but we can also move back even further. We can also pull in other historic events in a bit more depth, like the Arab Spring. You know, there's still some dynamics I didn't touch upon, where this is coming from exactly, and you know, what the effects are on, you know, societal development, for example. The religious dimension I haven't talked about. You know, there's the Shia and the Sunni Muslim divide, with Israelis being Jews and some Christian minorities involved as well. Turkey as a secular actor, you know, with a more Turkish stance on those things, has also not been included in the analysis. So there are some dimensions that I, you know, didn't touch upon, and that might, you know, affect the outcome. But in order to give a perspective of what the region is facing in the next couple of years, the first important thing to summarize the analysis is that I believe the fall of the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad was mainly due to concerted action between Israel, Turkey, and the Free Syrian Army, the Syrian rebels. And there are many reasons for that, as I discussed earlier. So I believe that this is the first major point. And the second is that I believe that Israel has much influence on the new Syrian government, because they are not materially institutionalized. They do not have the funds and the financial means to be shielded from foreign influence. Certainly, Turkey also has like some sort of influence on the new government. Syria lost a lot of territory, and they're going to continue to do so. But also, they are going to act in the interest of Israel and Turkey for the next couple of years. And once this system is established, and, you know, Israel can extract, and mainly Israel, because Israel then again, you know, has much more interest to be the strongest actor in new Syria. Once they established much of their grip there, I think Iraq is going to be next, and we might be seeing new insurgent groups with a whole new name, or maybe old names, who knows, under the banner of Islam popping up. And then we'll have all those stories again with, you know, weaponry delivered by the United States of America, Israel, and maybe also, you know, some generals and soldiers training those. We might have those stories again, stirring up Iraq, and then we have another civil war there. And with the power vacuum, we might also see, again, territorial expansions. All hypotheses, whether it's logic or not, logical or not, you know, you have to decide. I believe that, I hope that these are not going to become reality, but this remains to be seen. In the meantime, check out the article. I think very, very important thing to read on how we can assess the future of Arabia there. And I hope to produce more content in the future than over the last year. You know, it has been kind of busy, and my apologies for that. But thank you very much for listening. As I said, you can always reach out to me.